This is a poem by the Reverend Leslie Takahashi. It's called Marginal Wisdom. Reverend Leslie serves at the congregation in Walnut Creek. They teach us to read in black and white. Truth is, the rest is false. You are whole or broken. Who you love is acceptable or not. Life tells its truth in many hues. We are taught to think either or, to believe in the teachings of Jesus or Buddha, to believe in human potential or a power beyond a single will. I am broken or I am powerful. Life embraces multiple truths, speaks of both and of and. We are taught to see in absolutes, good versus evil, male versus female, old versus young, gay versus straight. Let us see the fractions, the spectrum, the margins. Let us open our hearts to the complexity of our worlds. Let us make our lives sanctuaries to nurture our many identities. The day is coming when all will know that the rainbow world is more gorgeous than monochrome, that a river of identities can ebb and flow over the static, stubborn rocks in its course, that the margins hold the center. I was a very fortunate kid. My parents, my mom in particular, did not see my gender as any sort of barrier. I was never told that because I was a girl, I couldn't do things. I was never warned about men treating women like second-class citizens. I was never told that I might be paid less than a man. I was never told that I might be looked at as a cute thing to have around, rather than a smart person who is a hard worker. And you know what? Most of these things never happened to me. Perhaps I've been lucky. Perhaps it's the self-fulfilling prophecy where if you expect a certain outcome, it often happens. Perhaps it was simply my loud, bossy, take-no-crap personality. I don't know. But the workplace has always been a welcoming place for me. Honestly, though, the most difficult times in my work life have been difficulties with female bosses. And it has most often been while working with women that I have felt like I didn't belong, like I wasn't capable. I think sometimes women are harder on other women than on men. I'm not sure. So I was a working mom. Being the parents of twin boys, Ken and I often celebrated Sunday nights, knowing that our long weekend of feedings, diaperings, cleaning, discipline, wiping up puke were nearly over. We could go to work tomorrow and get some rest. But once the boys entered school, I began to feel guilty. And it wasn't the guilt of leaving them. They had an in-home nanny with their cousin for a while, and then they loved daycare and preschool. No, it was the guilt of showing up for the in-class Halloween party or the end-of-year carnival where I felt like I didn't belong. While all the dads huddled together talking about work, coaching soccer, last night's football game, I stood by myself. The stay-at-home moms had a club and I wasn't part of it. I remember showing up to help with a Thanksgiving party and the kindergarten home mom looking at me like, I was pitiful. Her attitude was, I'm here every single week, and I'm going to make sure you don't get any gratitude for showing up this one day. In the days before Facebook, we had internet groups. I belonged to a working mothers group, and I'll be honest, we did a lot of bashing of stay-at-home moms. But over on another group I belonged to, the Mother of Twins group, I saw those stay-at-home moms complain of being taken advantage of by us working moms. They think we do nothing all day. I gained a lot of understanding about the life of working moms, but I can't say I ever really stopped feeling like I was being judged by them. And I know now some stay-at-home moms felt like they were being judged by working women. But what they didn't know is that I don't think I could have done what they did. I think they may have had the harder job than me, especially since I was lucky enough to be able to have a little help, and I had a very involved husband. But I did learn a valuable lesson. We never know what it's like to be in another's shoes, and to treat everyone as though they are living with a constant struggle of life, no matter how shiny their life looks on the outside.
The theme for this month is taken from the Unitarian Universalist First Principle. We covenant to affirm and promote the inherent worth and dignity of every person. Reverend Anne Marie Alderman says that the first principle is not a moral assessment. It is not a claim that human nature is basically good. It is not an attempt to condone terrible acts of violence or to passively accept the inevitability of evil. Instead, it is an active assertion that a human being, virtuous or not, good or evil, possesses a value that cannot be taken from them. It's a condition of our very humanity to believe this. A condition of our very humanity. That is to say that if I were to do something that didn't affirm your worth and dignity, that my humanity is diminished. The flip of this would be that if we uphold and support one another's unique intrinsic value, that our own humanity is increased. This past year, one of the most powerful books that I read was called All the Light We Cannot See by Anthony Doerr. It is the story of two young people during the Second World War. Werner is a young German orphan who is recruited to attend a Nazi training school when they learn of his skills with radios. At the school, the young, blonde, blue-eyed boys were trained to run for miles, to understand mathematics and a certain version of European history, and to follow orders, no matter what. They were also carefully trained to despise anyone who the Nazis deem as other, as despicable, as less than human. These sections of the book are painful to read, as most of the boys choose to join the energy of the group's anger, fear, and hatred. The Nazis' plan depended on their ranks' readiness to deny the worth and dignity of millions of people. Their plan depended on their soldiers and even on the average European citizen to be afraid to speak up on behalf of someone else, and instead to treat them as other. Robert Schreider, a Catholic professor of theology specializing in reconciliation and peacemaking, classified 7 ways that we can distinguish the other. We can demonize the other, treating the other as someone to be feared, even eliminated if possible. We can romanticize the other, treating the other as superior to ourselves. We can colonize the other, treating the other as inferior. We can generalize the other, treating the other as a non-individual. We can trivialize the other by ignoring what makes the other disturbingly different. We can homogenize the other by claiming that there really is no difference at all. We can vaporize the other by refusing to acknowledge that they even exist. With all of these ways to otherize someone or to feel that we are other, how might we also have just as many ways to reclaim our shared humanity? Reverend Nate Walker, who some of you may remember as offering our sermon at the installation here at 2012, suggests that cultivating empathy allows us to affirm the worth and dignity of every person, no exception. But I don't want to have empathy for them, I hear you thinking. But that's the practice. And why? Because protecting your humanity is worth the effort. One of the most useful tools in cultivating empathy is stretching our moral imagination. The moral imagination has been described as the ability to anticipate or project oneself into the middle of a moral dilemma or conflict and to understand all points of view. Now, I noticed that this didn't say project your judgment and personal views into the moral dilemma. It says project yourself into the conflict and to understand all points of view. It is the practice of being curious about how others might feel. Of course, it's important to remember that it is just our imagination, that we can't ever know how someone else feels unless we ask them and they choose to share that with us. In our story this morning, Lily saw that some bigger kids were teasing Wilson and Chester. She might have imagined that they were feeling afraid. She could have thought, well, they've never been very nice to me. It's about time they got what's coming to them. But she didn't. She went to help them. In her particular Lily way, with a nifty disguise and a squirt gun. I wonder what those big kids were feeling and why they needed to pick on a couple of little mice who were cautious and careful. In bigger real-life stories, Waitstill and Martha Sharp were living comfortable lives in Wellesley, Massachusetts. They were asked to give that comfort up. They were asked to leave their children, to travel to Europe and hopefully help save lives of those threatened by Nazis. There was no big financial reward. They were risking everything. The only motivation that they had was empathy and their own conviction that every person matters. They weren't saving people who were just like them. They were saving people of a different faith, people who spoke a different language, people who had different ways of doing things. But the Sharps could imagine that if their lives were in danger, that they would want someone to try and save them. And so they went. I am so grateful that Ken Burns has chosen to tell their story, and I look forward to being changed by that on Tuesday evening. Now, let's imagine that there's a community of faith offering something very precious. This community isn't offering the answers to all of life's big questions. Rather, a community in which to explore those questions together, allowing space for different answers to arise, or maybe to come to the same conclusions, grounded in different theologies. This is such a place. And offering that precious gift is not always easy. Most of us have been taught that we're supposed to have the answer. Many of us got gold stars, recognition, degrees, or employment because of what we knew. We might be the one in our family that everyone comes to with their questions. It feels good to know, right? So being in a congregation that strives to build a beloved community that respects diversities can require some unlearning and some relearning. Because here we get to practice being human, and we're reminded that we don't have a corner on knowledge or the truth. Like Wilson and Lily and Chester, we may have some things in common, and we bring beautiful diversities as well. Let's take a minute and recognize some of these wonderful differences in our beliefs and in our practices. And I invite you to participate if you're willing. I also invite you to look around while we do this so that you can see how other folks might be responding or not. Would you please raise your hand if you have a meditation practice? How about if you're drawn to the poetry of mystics, such as Rumi, Hafez, or Hildegard of Bingen? Please raise your hand if your theology has changed in the last decade. If you have a sense of connection with something more when you are in nature. If you find inspiration in the teachings or in the radical life of Jesus. If you light Shabbat candles or light a menorah. If you pray. If you're inspired by images of the goddess, if your experience of reality is defined solely by what one can know through the five senses and reason, if you've ever felt the presence of someone who has died, if you believe in the divine known by many names, if you aren't sure of your theology but are open to possibilities, if you too find it incredibly precious and challenging to worship with such a variety of beliefs and practices in the room. Our different theologies and practices are a strength. So let's not homogenize ourselves, pretending that we are all the same. Let's not be a don't ask, don't tell congregation when it comes to theology. Let's make space for beliefs without assuming that we are all the same. Let's cultivate empathy and practice glad curiosity. And it will take practice, dear people, because we have been taught that we are supposed to know or that there is only one way. So let's try it. If someone tells you something that is unfamiliar and you feel unsure or hesitant, rather than criticizing, try, "That's a new idea to me."
That's a new idea to me.
Or maybe, "Would you tell me more about that?
Would you tell me more about that?"
Maybe someone uses a word or phrase that doesn't match your theology. You could withdraw or lash out. Or you could flex your empathy muscles and strive for connection, rather than ignoring the comment, which just trivializes the speaker, or pretending that what they said was wrong, which demonizes them. You might try, "What does that mean to you?
What does that mean to you?"
You are good at this. Earlier, as you raised your hands in response to different questions, I witnessed that this congregation is not this or that. Rather, it is this and this and this, and this. Let us see the fractions, the spectrum, the margins. Let us open our hearts to the complexity of our worlds. Let us make our lives sanctuaries to nurture the fullness of who we are. The day is coming when all will know that a river of identities can ebb and flow over the static, stubborn rocks in its course, that the margins hold the center. Cultivating empathy and using our moral imaginations can have amazing consequences. In 2000, I attended a conference at Oregon State University, and I was able to hear the Rabbi Lawrence Kushner share a story of his aunt, who lived in Germany during the beginning of the Second World War. One day she was traveling on a train, and at one of the stops, two SS officers came on board and began asking people for their papers. She began to tremble, knowing that she did not have the papers that they were looking for. Then, to her horror, the man next to her began yelling, even as the officers were escorting others off of the train. He began yelling at her, and one of the officers came over to see what he was yelling about, and he said, "Oh, my wife. She forgot her papers at home. She is so forgetful, this woman." And he and the SS officer shared a laugh at the silly, forgetful woman. And the officer continued on. Empathy and moral imagination may ask us to step out of our comfort zones. It may save someone's life. It may help change the world. As Amy reminded us, we can never truly know what it is like to be someone else. And with empathy, we can stay in touch with our humanity that connects us to all of life. May we know that there is no other. Only our shared imperfections in which we stumble and fall, in which we can help one another to rise again and again. May it be so. Amen.